Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. WHO endorses a malaria vaccine for Africa.
This long-awaited malaria vaccine is a breakthrough for science, child health, and malaria control. Using this vaccine in addition to existing tools to prevent malaria could save tens of thousands of young lives each year.
Hundreds, including children, await a trial on terrorism charges in Burkina Faso. Malawi's president orders wider use of sign language. Eswatini Teachers Union says it does not support the return of all students to the classroom, at least for now. And Ethiopia's prime minister reshuffles his cabinet amid continuing conflict in the country's Tigray region.
In both cases, this reflects the struggles that the administration is facing on the security front. I think we'll have to wait to see more about how much influence the new defense minister has.
And the impact of climate change in Mali and the need for solutions. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The World Health Organization has approved the RTSS malaria vaccine, marking a milestone in the fight against the disease. The recommendation is based on results from an ongoing pilot program in Kenya, Ghana, and Malawi that has reached more than 800,000 children since 2019. As Marine Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, Africa continues to bear the heaviest malaria burden, with hundreds of thousands of children dying every year.
According to the World Health Organization, one child dies of malaria in every 2 minutes as the disease remains leading killer of young children in sub-Saharan Africa. Across the three pilot countries, which are Kenya, Ghana, and Malawi, more than 800,000 children have received at least one vaccine dose and 2.3 million doses have been administered since 2019. Speaking in a virtual press conference, the World Health Organization Director General Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus said that use of the RTSS vaccine to prevent malaria could save thousands of young lives each year.
WHO is recommending the broad use of the world's first malaria vaccine. This long-awaited malaria vaccine is a breakthrough for science, child health, and malaria control. Using this vaccine in addition to existing tools to prevent malaria could save tens of thousands of young lives each year. Community demand for the vaccine is strong.
With more than 400,000 malaria deaths recorded annually across the world, two-thirds of the deaths in children under the age of five occur in Africa. WHO Regional Director for Africa, Dr. Mashidiso Moet, said that the vaccine recommendation offers hope for the African continent.
We expect many more African children will be protected from malaria and grow into healthy and productive adults. The RTSS vaccine is a game changer, and it's arriving at the right time. Progress in reducing the malaria burden in Africa has stalled in recent years, and innovative tools and approaches are urgently needed to get the global malaria control effort back on track.
Based on the advice of two WHO global advisory bodies, one for immunization and the other for malaria, the vaccine introduction is achievable, improves health, and saves lives. Dr. Alejandro Cravioto, chair WHO Strategic Advisory Group of Experts on Immunization, has given an assurance that the malaria vaccine is safe.
We can declare that the vaccine is safe and that the safety issues that came out of the initial trial have been resolved satisfactorily and thoroughly to be able to say that we don't have any worries about that. And second, that the vaccine does protect people against a severe disease, such as malaria, and especially the more severe types of malaria.
With Kenya being among the most affected countries in Africa by malaria, the Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta, who is also the current chairman of the African Leaders Malaria Alliance, ALMA, last week said that it was unfortunate that COVID-19 had overshadowed all the efforts that had gone into fighting malaria.
We want to ensure that the great work of the Global Fund and all our other partners have contributed over the years in helping us fight malaria will not be reversed in the coming years.
World Health Organization says malaria remains a primary cause of childhood illness and death in sub-Saharan Africa. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed on Wednesday announced the reordering of his cabinet with major changes, including the ministers of defense and peace. This comes as Abiy faces increasing international criticism because of the conflicts in the country's Tigray region and also because of the expulsion last week of United Nations officials. Jason Mosley is the senior associate researcher for the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. He says while the changes are routine because the Prime Minister has just won re-election, the new ministers of defense and peace could signal a new direction.
The first thing to say would be obviously that he's just had his mandate officially renewed after the parliamentary elections have been held now. So this is just the sort of natural process of his second term officially starting this new mandate coming off of these elections, whereas previously he had taken over as the chairman of the former ruling party, whose mandate came from the 2015 elections.
The prime minister is under pressure, particularly because of the war in the Tigray province. So what does that mean if he has made changes with the defense minister?
Yes, there were two security-related changes. In both cases, this reflects the struggles that the administration is facing on the security front. I think we'll have to wait to see more about how much influence the new defense minister has as the former head of the interim Tigray administration that was set up after the initial occupation last year. Of course, that interim administration was then expelled in the summer during the fighting, and how that it spread into Amhara and Afar regions. That's created these challenges and precipitated this sort of reshuffle with the defense ministry and the Ministry for Peace. That peace ministry will presumably also play a significant role in whatever dialogue process the prime minister tries to start in order to sort of create the impression of an agenda around reconciliation and coalition building.
This past week, Abe has been involved in a row with the United Nations, particularly his expulsion of the UN officials. So it seems to me perhaps the Ethiopian prime minister is just saying that maybe he doesn't care what the international community says about what's going on in Ethiopia.
Well, I think one of the real conundrums for the international community that's concerned about the deteriorating humanitarian situation in the country, and although the situation in Tigray is particularly acute as the fighting has spread outside the borders of Tigray, that conflict-induced humanitarian issues have now spread into Amhara and Afar. There was already conflict in many other parts of the country by disputes between central government and political parties that were not on board with Abiy's assertive agenda since 2018. So there were parts of Oromo, area around Somali, and the Afar region, the Somali-Oromo borders, all over the country affected by insecurity for the last several years, all of which is exacerbated by disputes with the international community. But what has tended to happen over the last year is as the international community talks tough or threatens sanctions or starts to implement sanctions, there are some very, very narrow and specific sanctions in place already, but the framework for American sanctions of a broader nature is in place now and hasn't been implemented. But all that pressure has simply caused the administration of Abiy Ahmed and the interesting alignment of his base, the former ruling party that he's transformed into the Prosperity Party, minus the Tigrayan component, which is, of course, controlling Tigray now, and this conflict exists, plus opposition parties that have tended to be pan-Ethiopian and with a strong base in the diaspora. So he's connected, he's brought in the chairman of the National Movement for the Amhara and the leader of the Ethiopian Citizens for Social Justice, which is an opposition coalition, into the cabinet, and a former senior Oromo Liberation Front figure who defected the Oromo Liberation Front has split many times over the years. But bringing these guys in is an attempt to shore up constituencies in his own Oromo region where he comes from, but also with this constituency of ethnic Amhara, who there is an Amhara region, but because of the sort of historical context of Ethiopia, there are ethnic Amhara or people with ethnic Amhara heritage all over the country, especially in urban areas.
Jason Mosley is the Senior Associate Researcher for the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. He was speaking with us from Stockholm. Teachers in Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, say they are not in favor of all students returning to the classrooms next Monday, October 11. Mbangwa Dlamini, the president of the Swaziland National Association of Teachers, also known as SNAT, says there was rotational attendance because of COVID-19 protocols, and the teachers were expecting for the government to first ease the protocols before returning all students to the classroom. Eswatini students have been boycotting classes and burning down school buildings in support of the pro-democracy movement in the country. The government has blamed the teachers' union for inciting students to boycott classes.
At the moment, we do not have a policy because we haven't met as an executive yet, because we only learned about it from the social media that the minister has announced the opening of schools on Monday, whereby she is expecting every student to attend to school on Monday, regardless of the fact that schools, the rotation was brought about by the COVID-19 protocols. We were expecting, one, that the government should maybe ease the lockdown if maybe the reason for the lockdown was COVID-19. So if the lockdown is eased, then we'd understand if numbers will be allowed to increase in schools. But our major problem is that besides the issue of COVID-19, now we have got political instability in the country, whereby we have been seeing a number of students rioting in different schools, resulting in some schools being burnt down. And also, today we have heard that one teacher was assaulted by the rioting student, which the situation is exposing our members to all sorts of danger. And now our worry is that the ministry was supposed to consult the SNAT as the stakeholder before they decide to open schools. So we feel that it is wrong by the government to decide unilaterally to open schools without involving the union.
Well, let me ask you, because you mentioned the rioting of the students. The Prime Minister, Mr. Cleopas Dlamini, my understanding, he has accused you, the teachers, of inciting the students to engage in class boycotts as part of your demand for democratic reforms. Are you inciting students to boycott school?
Thank you, my brother, on that one. That one is our major concern. We are worried about the attitude by the government in this situation. The government is not in a position to solve problems that are being raised by the students. Instead, government wants to label teachers that they are the ones who are perpetrating these riots in schools. What we observed as the SNAT is that the very same Prime Minister said that they are still going to investigate in order to establish what are the causes of these riots. My question is, then because we have labeled teachers as the one who perpetrated this violence, what are the bases of such labels? Because the first thing that you can do, you start by investigating, then the investigation is going to inform you on who are the suspects. Now, what is going to happen, I think the government is going to try and identify some teachers whom they feel are supposed to be eliminated in the system and direct such investigation to their suspicions. In our understanding, that is tantamount to witch hunt.
My understanding, there was another arson attack on another high school on Wednesday. Is that true?
Yes, today there was an arson attack at Wukanyan High School, whereby the school was burnt and students were rioted.
Why do you think the students are choosing to burn down their own school buildings? Don't you think that destroys their chances of going to school?
In fact, there are various reasons, my brother. Students have lost hope in the education system of the country, in the sense that they've seen their brothers or their sisters, they have completed school, but they are not employed, they are not even in tertiary. Even those who have gone through tertiary, they are not employed, they are at home without any employment. So now they don't understand, as teachers, why we say education is key to success when they see people who have gone through the school system, yet they remain in poverty.
Mbangwa Dlamini is the president of the Swaziland National Association of Teachers. You are speaking with us from the capital, Mbabane. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 7th. Malawi's President Lastra Chakwera has ordered sign language to be used on all television stations at official functions and to be recognized as a national language. Malawi's sign language users, numbering some 400,000 people, have welcomed the move, as Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
President Lazarus Chakwera said he was concerned with the challenges deaf people in the country face, largely because of lack of sign language interpreters. He said the problem stems from the fact that most people do not regard sign language as important.
We must stop thinking of sign language as a favor to deaf people. That kind of conversation has no place in this new Malawi that we're building. We need a re-education of our minds to regard sign language as a human right.
Chakwera said every person has a right to acquire education from the moment they are born, including sign language for people born with hearing impairments.
In this new Malawi, we want the use of sign language to be adopted everywhere, for every function, and by every institution.
Chakwera has therefore ordered the Ministry of Information to ensure that all television stations have sign language interpreters. Chakwera said his administration will work with Malawi National Association of the Deaf, MANAD, to make life easier for the country's 400,000 sign language users.
It is because of this commitment that we are supporting the reproduction of the first ever Malawian Sign Language Dictionary developed by MANAD to help harmonize the existing sign languages in Malawi into one sign language.
Chimwemwe Kankwamba is a partially deaf student at Exports University in the capital, Lilongwe. She said youth with hearing difficulties are denied loans to start their businesses.
We are excluded because they feel like we cannot pay back those loans, and which is not the right thing, because we are also persons. We are also people with needs. We are also people who want to be somewhere. And to be denied that is, we are being denied our right to do what we believe we can do.
Stefano Manea is the chairperson for the Malawi National Association of the Deaf. He says another challenge is there is only one secondary school for deaf learners in Malawi. He spoke through an interpreter.
So our plea is that government should help us with the special secondary school for the deaf, so that after these learners who do better in a special setup graduate from primary school, they should also get the specialized support in special secondary schools and be able to excel with their education.
Chakwera said his government will look into that, but he said his administration will first focus on training more people who can use sign language in government offices. Malawi currently only has 5 professional sign language interpreters. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
In Burkina Faso, at least 400 people have been awaiting trial on terrorism charges for years, including several minors. In this report from Ouagadougou, Henry Wilkins speaks to family members of those living in legal limbo.
Heretu Sidibe says 3 relatives, including her son, have been held at a maximum security prison in the town of Zanare for 3 years since their arrest. Sidibe, whose name has been changed to protect her identity, says she does not know why they're being held and rarely has the chance to see them. Sidibe says it has been more than a year since she was able to visit her relatives, because she doesn't have the money to get from the town where she lives to where they are incarcerated. She says her brother was able to visit 2 weeks ago, however. Since Burkina Faso began its war against armed groups linked to Islamic State, Al-Qaeda and local bandits 7 years ago, at least 400 citizens have been arrested on suspicion of terrorism-related offences and are being held in custody. Some are children under the age of 16. The West African country created a penal code for terrorism offences in 2019, but so far only 2 people have been to trial and convicted on terrorism charges. Sidibe says the prison where her relatives are being held is overcrowded at double its official capacity. She says, I really need some judicial assistance, a lawyer to follow up their case and free them, because it really is a long time that they've been remanded in prison. Kumbo Barry, whose name has been changed to protect her identity, says her son has been held for almost 2 years without trial. Tearfully, she says she can't stop crying because she hasn't been given any reason for her son's arrests. She wants the government authorities to help her find the reason why her sons were arrested and sent to prison. She complains she is old and cannot work while she continues to live with her sons, wives and children. It's difficult to feed them and her husband is old, so everyone is suffering at home because of the situation, she adds. Daouda Diallo is a Burkinabe human rights activist who runs the rights group, the Collective Against Impunity and Stigmatization of Communities, CISC. He says some detainees have been awaiting trial for as long as 5 years. He says, as a defender of human rights, he thinks that this pre-trial detention is excessive. It's an abuse that must be corrected at the level of the law, because we cannot detain someone indefinitely to wait for his or her trial. The fact that justice isn't working can contribute to further violence and worsening vigilantism, he says. Burkina Faso's military and local militias have both been accused of carrying out extrajudicial killings in recent years. Attending a conference on the processing of terrorism offences Friday, Burkina Faso President Roch Kabore said the country will continue to prosecute terrorism suspects despite funding concerns. He says, we're pleased we've been able to hold the first trial of a terrorist, and I can tell you that I've noted all the concerns and we will ensure that the state can effectively meet these conditions. He says it's true that we have to take into account the fact that we have financial difficulties, but I think an effort can be made to reinforce what we already have. Although the trial and conviction of two men is a sign of progress, it remains to be seen how quickly more trials will follow. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
In the past 30 years, Mali's temperature has risen 7% on average, while rainfall has fallen by 6.7%. In the north and near Timbuktu, the population is double, affected by climate change and continued conflict. Jeremy Reynolds is head of the Mali delegation of International Committee of the Red Cross. He spoke to Ricky Stryak about the impact of these issues on residents in northern Mali and how they should be addressed at the upcoming COP26 conference on climate change.
So I think, first of all, to try and understand the causes and the scale of the issue. I mean, I think that's the first important step, and so that's really listening to people on the ground, the local communities, hearing the challenges they face. So really, I think the first key step is to try and have as good an understanding as possible of the issue, the causes and the consequences that brings to people, and then really to try and design programming that takes that into account and offers a possibility for communities to be as resilient as possible.
And when you say as resilient as possible, what kind of impacts are they, I guess, needing to be resilient from?
Challenge that many parts, not all parts of Mali, but many parts of Mali face, and I think particularly the central north, is a sort of a multidimensional crisis in that we have, for the last 10 years or so, we've had, the effects of conflict and violence on many, many communities, which also, I think, and that's important not to forget, has maybe sort of weakened the response that, the state and the extension actors in agriculture, in livestock, if there hadn't been the conflict, those sort of services would certainly be stronger than they are at the moment. So that sort of the conflict has a direct impact on, causes displacement and people are wounded or killed. But I think it also sort of undermines the ability of the state, of agricultural extension services, for example, to play the role that usually they would be playing. And then on top of that, we have, the sort of climate crisis. And it's a much sort of longer, I think if the conflict is a sort of, here and now impact, the climate crisis is a sort of more longer term phenomenon. So I think the impact, I guess, is that kind of really complex mix of here and now as a result of the conflict, indirect impact that, the state services that would normally help people be more resilient are weakened, and then the sort of more medium long term effects of the climate crisis.
That was Jeremy Reynolds, the International Committee of the Red Cross head of Mali delegation. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Bamako. And that's it for this Thursday, October 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington wishing you